From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, filling in for Lori Walsh, and you are in the moment. And welcome to this week's news podcast. This week, political junkies talk the state's top political headlines. A federal judge will hear arguments on the merits of a lawsuit brought by tribes against President Trump. How can you better protect your data? We have you covered. And we hear from two Rapid City businesswomen selected for this year's Native American 40 Under 40. But first, Jackie Hendry spent Monday and Tuesday covering the Frank Lemire Presidential Forum. Let's take a listen.
The two-day Frank Lemire Native American Presidential Forum gives candidates for the nation's highest office a chance to learn from and respond to tribal citizens and their concerns. It's named for Winnebago activist Frank Lemire, who was instrumental in shutting down liquor sales in White Clay, Nebraska. Lemire died from cancer this June. 11 presidential candidates, 10 Democrats, and one independent are participating. Each candidate is given 45 minutes to respond to questions from a panel of indigenous elders, youth, and leaders. The Native American voting rights group, Four Directions, is one of the event hosts. It was founded in Mission on the Rosebud Reservation more than 15 years ago. O.J. Siemens is a founder and co-executive director of Four Directions. In his opening remarks on the Orpheum Theater stage in Sioux City yesterday, he tells the audience this event serves as Indian Country 101 for the candidates and the country.
We, the Native people of America, this is our house today. When we invite people here, we're inviting them into our homes. And so we need to show our custom, our tradition, our culture, and we need to treat all the candidates with respect. What I want you to know, and you know, we're talking about presidential candidates, you know, and we all know at the end of the day, one's gonna get nominated. But here's the thing, regardless of who that person is, we have an opportunity to show our issues. We're not going to take and let anybody else's agenda come in here and take our agenda, to take our issues. We are here as a Native voice.
Just a few of the issues discussed in the first day included criminal justice, missing and murdered Indigenous women, mental health concerns, economic development, and much more. The forum attracted Native groups from around the nation. Kevin Aulis is the CEO of the National Congress of American Indians. It's the oldest and largest organization focused on serving tribal communities. He tells the audience neither tribes nor the candidates can afford to underestimate the impact of millions of Native American voters.
Let me just give you some numbers that really put this into perspective that each of these candidates need to think about as they move forward in this election cycle. We may be only 5.2 million people in this country, 1.7% of the population, but Indian Country is the fastest growing group of people in the United States. Since the year 2000, we've grown by 27% compared to 9% the rest of the country. And when you look at some of our populations across the country and you look at swing states and you look at how we can make a difference this year, let me share some other information with you. The state of Michigan, in 2016, the margin of victory was a little over 11,000 votes, 0.24%. There are 110,000 registered Native Americans in the state of Michigan, carries 16 electoral votes. The state of Wisconsin, the margin of error was victory was 27,000, 0.93%. There are 79, almost 80,000 registered voters in the state of Wisconsin. That's another 10 electoral votes. The state of Arizona, 84,000 vote margin of victory, 4.1% of the vote. There are 324,000 registered Native American voters in Arizona. Folks, that's over 43 electoral votes in 2020. We matter. Our issues matter. And our votes matter. So it's important that when we listen to these candidates that come and speak to us today and have taken the time out of their busy schedules to really recognize important issues in Indian Country, we also have to look in the mirror and understand that it's our responsibility no matter what the hurdles are, to find a way to get to that voting box and cast your vote. Because we can change the election this year.
The first candidate of day one of the Frank Lemire Presidential Forum and the first candidate to agree to the forum is author Marianne Williamson, Democratic candidate for president. She said as president, she'd return the Black Hills to the Lakota, and one of her first acts would be removing the portrait of Andrew Jackson from the Oval Office. One of Williamson's panelists was Lisa Whitepipe from Rosebud. She asks Williamson about tribal involvement in development.
While we as nations clearly support economic growth, we do have a different analysis considering the sacredness of our lands. And I'm sure you have seen that at Standing Rock, and it's happening in Hawaii now. And tribes in South Dakota will be facing those same issues with KXL coming in. As president, how will you ensure that the sacred sites are protected and tribes are consulted prior to any development?
There are certain places where we continue to compromise with oil and gas companies, with chemical companies, with other multinational corporate entities whose profitability and short-term profit maximization goals are simply at odds with environmental protection and cultural respect.
Williamson also tells the audience she supports the Remove the Stain Act, which revokes the Medals of Honor awarded to U.S. soldiers who participated in the Wounded Knee Massacre in 1890. But by far the biggest crowd of the day turned out for Senator Elizabeth Warren. After an endorsement from New Mexico representative and one of the first Native women to serve in Congress, Deb Haaland, Warren was greeted by a standing ovation. Warren has been one of the more divisive candidates in Indian country, with many tribal citizens unimpressed by her response to President Trump's jabs at her claims of Cherokee ancestry. But after a few opening thanks, Warren issued an apology of sorts.
Like anyone who's being honest with themselves, I know that I have made mistakes. I am sorry for harm I have caused. I have listened and I have learned a lot. And I am grateful for the many conversations that we've had together. It is a great honor to be able to partner with Indian country. And that's what I've tried to do as a senator. And that's what I promise I will do as president of the United States of America.
The rest of Warren's time focused on the need for broad reform to address federal failures to meet treaty obligations. Just days before the forum, she and Representative Haaland announced their Honoring Promises to Native Nations Act, which is now open for public comment. And when asked how she'd support tribal sovereignty in law enforcement in particular, Warren surprised some by suggesting the reversal of Oliphant versus Suquamish Indian Tribe. That's the 1978 Supreme Court ruling that prevents tribal court jurisdiction over non-tribal citizens. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar was the third candidate to take the stage. Cheyenne River Tribal Chairman Harold Frazier was one of her panelists. When the time came to pose his question, he brought attention to the ongoing impact of this spring's flooding on the reservation and his distrust of federal institutions.
You know, one of the things that we've been faced with on our reservation, we're in the north central part of South Dakota, and in our region too, in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska, we've had a pretty tough spring with a lot of flooding. And one of the things that has impacted us greatly is our roads. I mean, right now, today, it's just a travesty, the condition of our roads on our reservations. There is several issues that need to be dealt with. And there's a long-term solution and also a short-term. And when you look at the short-term, it's pretty hard when you try to deal with federal highways to get federal disaster money when they won't even return your call. I mean, these floodings have been going on since April. Damages to our roads. Right now on our reservation, we have 5 culverts that have washed out completely. So we have 5 detours on our reservation. We have a couple slide areas, so forth. The BIA come down and they couldn't believe the damage of our roads. And in 2 days, a bus is gonna be running down there. I'll tell you what, nobody cares. Nobody cares. it's shameful to see the neglect in your own backyard, and you see the millions of dollars that are being played with. The 4th of July parade is one example. But yet, they can't even fund to fix roads on reservation. You know, what good is having, you talk about school. I mean, that's good. But talk is talk. And we have seen nothing from anybody, from Federal Highways to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, nobody. And, till I see something happen, I have no faith in the federal government. We've been lied to enough. And that needs to stop. I mean, it's just all lip service. I've been all over in Washington. I've been out into Indian country. I went to a lot of areas to drum up support to bring up this issue. And yet, I don't see anything. I see not only there's a tribe down the southwest, probably a second largest reservation in the United States, and they only have 2 BIA maintenance workers, road maintenance workers. I mean, it's just shameful. Here's how they fix the road. They put a sign. Half the road's gone. Half the road's gone. Yeah, we have a road on our reservation, BIA Route 9, that has been closed since May 26th. And who cares? And who cares? I mean, I could go on. There was some fatalities up in Standing Rock. You know, and the story of that one is the BIA knew about it. The paperwork was sitting in the area office so they could draw it down and start moving to repair that culvert. 2 people died. And you know what? Nobody cares. Nobody cares in Washington. Nobody cares anywhere because there's been no positive feedback. There's nothing coming down.
Okay, so I care. And in fact, I think Melanie would vouch for me. And one of the things that I have done in my state is that I go to the reservations routinely. I visit every county every single year, the smallest, reddest counties, the most impoverished counties in rural areas. And I do that because otherwise you're not going to be able to see with your own eyes and bring back the stories to try to fix things. And I use the story of the tribal school because that's something we did together, our delegation, and we did it because we made a big deal out of it and people started to feel embarrassed about it and they acted. And the reason I brought up roads early with Fix the Damn Roads is because I understand that you are not going to be able to conduct commerce or have any kind of economic opportunity or people aren't going to want to stay on your lands if you don't have roads. So my 2 solutions when it comes to this infrastructure issue. The first one, as you say, is immediate, and that's putting the actual money into it. I put this $1 trillion plan out, and it's paid for, every dime of it. And it is paid for by, first of all, taking the Trump tax cuts, where all this money went to the top 1%, and taking that corporate tax rate, which went way down faster than anyone ever thought, to 21%. Even if you put it at 25%, which I think the business thought it was going to be anyway, that gets you $400 billion right there. Then you get another $150 billion by going back to the way they did the international taxes before. You can do an infrastructure financing authority that brings in a couple hundred billion. You can do that and make sure the tribal communities are included in those that financing. And then you also can do some government bonds. You have to get this done. And you have to make sure the tribal communities are included. And make sure green infrastructure, which brings me to the second solution, which is taking on the issue of climate change. Because as you know, some of this flooding is getting worse because our country didn't have the same respect for our environment that your tribal community has. First of all, we are now the only country in the world that is not in the International Climate Change Agreement. When Donald Trump announced he was getting us out of that, it was Nicaragua and Syria weren't in it. Now they got in it. We are the only ones. And yes, and on day, okay. Thank you. And on day one, I will get us into that International Climate Change Agreement and work on those environmental issues. So I think that, as well as putting the money into infrastructure, has got to be a major priority as we go forward. All right.
Well, I'm personally going to invite you to come to our reservation.
I will.
And you see the condition of these roads.
Okay.
And when I mentioned the other solution. Say no. Anyway, the other part And we got historical data to prove this. I mean, nationally, the budget has doubled. But yet, on the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, because of this formula, we still receive $2.2 million. So you could put a $500 billion in there, I'll guarantee you we're still going to receive $2.2 million. And when you got all these issues of these roads, like I want to remind you, Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Reservation is the fourth largest in Indian country. And to receive that, it's almost criminal. So the EPW committee just sent out a draft of the bill. I'd ask you to read it. And it's really shameful and disheartening to see that there's a provision in that bill is to take care of wildlife at $250 million a year. But yet the entire road budget within the Indian country is at $500. So it's like they're putting wildlife ahead of human lives. And that needs to stop. So thank you.
All right.
The day's final candidate joined by video conference yesterday. At first blush, Montana Governor Steve Bullock might seem like the readiest candidate to discuss Native issues. 11 tribes and 7 reservations fall within Montana's borders, and its state legislature boasts the highest number of Native lawmakers of any state in the country. One of Bullock's panelists was Crow Creek Tribal Chairman Lester Thompson Jr. He questioned Bullock on the Indian Child Welfare Act and his view on judicial appointments.
As introduced, Governor, my name is Lester Thompson, Jr. I'm the current sitting chairman of the Hunkpati Dakota Oyate, also known as the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe. I humbly come before you today and humbly come before our elders. Now, to the elders, I ask for forgiveness. Again, I'm humbled and honored to be in your presence and to be able to speak today. Governor, my question today is going to be pointed at what I hold as probably the most sacred resource in Indian country and probably the world. It is towards our children. My topic is Indian Child Welfare Act. The Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted in 1978 to address the stark number of Native children being taken from their families and communities. At the time, 25 to 35% of all Native children were being taken from their parents, and of those, 85% of children were placed with non-Native families and outside of their tribal communities. Even today, Native children are still 4 times overrepresented in foster care. Despite the success and importance of ICWA, a judge in Texas ruled the law unconstitutional last October. This ruling was overturned by the Fifth Circuit no more than a couple weeks ago. My question to you is, as president, how will you protect landmark legislation like ICWA and other laws designed to uphold the rights of tribes to protect the welfare, well-being, and fate of our children? Add it, what qualifications will you look for in judicial nominees who may hear cases regarding tribal sovereignty?
I think, Mr. Chair, your discussion of ICWA and its importance was so significant. And when the Fifth Circuit then upheld that, I mean, it does ensure, it takes another one of those stains from the past away where families were being separated and ensures that families can stay together. I will do everything possible both to maintain ICWA, but also your point about judges is important. And, you know, I look at our U.S. Supreme Court right now as but one example of just about every judge is from somewhere what they'd call the Acela Corridor, right? It's all the East Coast. Sovereignty, ICWA, water rights, so many of those issues are legal issues to them. They're not living issues. Meaning that so many of the judges, certainly appointed at the highest bench, have no exposure or understanding of what Indian country is and the unique challenges and the unique opportunities outside of a textbook.
Day two opened with former 3-star Admiral Joe Sestak, who launched his bid for the Democratic nomination in June. Crow Creek Tribal Chairman Lester Thompson Jr. was part of SESDAC's panel, and he used his time to question the candidate on policy related to mental health. Chairman Thompson notes the suicide rate is up 139% for Native women and 71% for Native men since 1999. He asked SESDAC how he'd address mental health care and lack of funding in Indian Country. Here's part of SESDAC's response.
But if the proper funding were going in, and the best mental health care you can get in this nation, according to a study of RAND or New England Journal of Medicine, is in the VA. It should be the same way, because there's no difference of how Indian health services and all are provided. It's very similar, and you know that. And it should be on the same way that they do it, because it's integrated care. And the mental health is there on the front line, sitting next to the physical doctor, and that's another way they do it. But it's inadequate here.
The lone independent candidate to participate in the forum was Mark Charles, himself a member of the Navajo Nation. He opened his time with a condemnation of elements of founding documents of the United States, like the Declaration of Independence, calling it, quote, a white supremacist document based on the segment that refers to Native peoples as merciless Indian savages. When he was asked if he supports the Remove the Stain Act to rescind the 20 Medals of Honor given to U.S. soldiers after the Wounded Knee Massacre, Mark Charles did not hesitate to agree. He points out that three of the medals were awarded to soldiers who directed fire into a ravine where Lakota people were hiding.
Absolutely, we need to rescind these medals. They have no place in a nation that claims to value freedom and equality and diversity and pluralism. These medals are not only a stain, they are blood dripping from the clothes of this nation. We don't just need to rescind them, we need to wash the clothes.
That was a stark contrast to the much more guarded response to the same question from former representative and Democratic candidate John Delaney.
And this is always a very difficult issue, which is what you do with medals as we look back over time and have different standards and apply different things. And I think it's incredibly important that each one of those situations be looked at, because there's families and there's stories associated with these things. And I'd want to do that before I would commit to this specific situation and the specific individuals. So I can't say right now, because I haven't gone through the 20 stories and the 20 situations.
However, Delaney says he will sign the act as president. All other candidates of the day voiced very clear support of the Remove the Stain Act. Former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Julian Castro took the stage next. He's the first 2020 candidate to launch a distinct platform on Native American issues. That platform focuses on topics like housing, sovereignty, pipelines, and health care. Cheyenne River Tribal Chairman Harold Frazier asked Castro how his administration will tackle the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And Chairman Frazier uses the example of an elder on his reservation who continues to pray for the return of his daughter, Sharon Bald Eagle, who's been missing since 1983. Castro responded with support of legislation like Savannah's Act, which requires consultation between U.S. attorneys and tribes.
And that the federal government gets more serious by investing the resources for investigation and by keeping track, by tracking the cases of missing and murdered women and girls who are Natives, which we don't do, haven't done, with the same kind of precision that you would if somebody was missing, you know, that's non-Native.
Castro also received a very positive response when he discussed his plan to tackle homelessness, specifically for Native American veterans, by strengthening tribal liaison programs in federal departments like Housing and Urban Development, and reinstituting the Tribal Leadership Summit at the White House. That hasn't happened since 2016. He also talked about establishing an Indigenous Council at the White House to improve that relationship. The audience ended up giving Castro a standing ovation after his time was up. Later, Senator Kamala Harris joined via Skype. Chairman Frazier asked her why, when she was serving as California Attorney General, her office denied tribal requests to regain land out of trust. Harris answered, first stating that the nation needs to understand the U.S. government stole land from Native tribes.
As the lawyer, as the law office for the governor, we had to file those letters. But that was never a reflection and has never been a reflection of my personal perspective. And when I have had the ability to independently act, not on behalf of a client, I think my history and my positions are very clear, which is that there has to be a restoration of tribal land. And my view is very strongly that the acquisition of land in trust is essential to tribal self-determination and providing the foundation for not only economic but also political growth, and it has to be honored.
Later during her panel, Editor-in-Chief of Indian Country Today, Mark Trahant, who was moderator of the panels throughout 2 days, asked Kamala Harris how she might, or what needs to happen to improve representation of Native Americans in the country's judicial system. She responded by saying simply, "We need a new president." And that response drew widespread applause. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, also joined by Skype, Oglala Sioux Tribal President Julian Bear Runner was one of his panelists. President Bear Runner asked de Blasio a two-part question. First, how would he facilitate the return of the Black Hills to the Lakota people? And second, would de Blasio support clemency for Leonard Peltier, who's serving 2 life sentences connected to the deaths of FBI agents after a shootout during the occupation of Wounded Knee in the mid-70s? De Blasio agreed clemency is overdue.
I will do anything I can to support you in seeking that clemency. It's time. In terms of how we make right the history, again, I always will tell you when I don't know the exact path, but that I think if we meet in mutual respect, the path often will become evident. The history referred to around the Black Hills must be answered. It can't be ignored.
De Blasio went on to say he doesn't have a better answer than that, but hopes to work together with tribes to come to a solution. The final candidate of the forum drew by far the largest crowd and the warmest reception. Senator Bernie Sanders has received widespread support in Indian Country, in part for his stances on climate change and support of demonstrations at Standing Rock. Faith Spotted Eagle, an Ihonktewan elder from the Yankton area, told Senator Sanders about her need of a knee replacement. She says she's been waiting 15 years, but IHS won't support the surgery because the issue isn't life-threatening. Sanders, a supporter of universal health care, says that level of care is a human right.
We will reform fundamentally the Indian Health Service so that it will take care of your knee and the needs of all Native American people. And the truth of the matter is, you know, I know people say, well, you know, the truth is this, within the context of a multi-trillion-dollar federal government, is not an expensive proposition. We could provide quality health care to every Native American person, and trust me, it'll cost a lot less than one new weapon system for the Pentagon. All right, so...
Limited time meant only 3 of Sanders' panelists were able to pose their questions before the forum wrapped, and the senator met with tribal leaders privately. Hundreds of attendees from around the nation were part of this historic forum, the first of its kind, to invite presidential candidates to directly discuss Native interests with Native peoples. 4 Directions, the Native American Voting Rights Group, Executive Director O.J. Siemens, who is one of the event's organizers and a member of the Rosebud Tribe, told audiences yesterday not to let this be the only 2 days America knows they exist.
Each Wednesday on the radio program, we feature political junkies from around the state to talk South Dakota's top political headlines. Here's what we have for you this week.
This week, we welcome John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, who joins us by phone from Madison. John Hunter, welcome back.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks.
And also joining us today, John Schaff at the Tom and Danielle Amen Foundation Studio in Aberdeen. Dr. Schaff, professor of political science at Northern State University. Dr. Schaff, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here, Jackie. Thank you.
All right, so we'll get to the industrial hemp study in a second, but some sort of late breaking news this morning. A Democratic candidate expected to announce their campaign challenging U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson. That announcement expected at the joint Lincoln and Minnehaha County Democratic Party's annual event this Friday night, but no names in that press release. Who could it be?
John Schaffel, no.
I was afraid you were going to ask me because I looked this up, and I do know who it is. I don't have the name in front of me because I've now forgotten
Raver. It.
There we go.
There it is.
Thank God you have it in front of you. Whitney Raver, who is from somewhere in the Black Hills area. She ran for legislature in 2018 as a Democrat in District 30. And apparently she has filed papers with the FEC to run. So assuming that's who this announcement is, it's not that much of a secret because they're holding back the name. But I assume that's who it is. And so this would be a statewide candidate for the Democrats challenging Dusty Johnson. And I guess we'll see how things develop and how she frames her campaign. I think last time when she was running for state legislature, health care was a big issue for her. And we'll see if that's the same thing as she runs for national office this time.
Right. I was curious, assuming it is Whitney Raver, what do we know about her so far? We're hearing health care was a big part of the last campaign. Do we know much else about her?
No, if you got anything, John, go ahead.
I don't. It's kind of a non-traditional path. There are people who serve in government or have served in the legislature or in staff positions and so forth. And I think Americans and South Dakotans are maybe open to people who don't have any of that experience. I think since they're frustrated maybe with the current situation, they would be open to it. Whitney Raver appears to have no political experience at all, or having worked in government or in any of those processes. Ran for the legislature, as John said, in District 30, and did not win. And then, so now to make this leap to there, it's a leap of faith for her and for voters. But it is certainly a non-traditional path.
Something to keep an eye on. We'll see if our suspicions are correct Friday night when that announcement comes. So now kind of back to what we were planning on talking about today, the state's industrial hemp study met again this week. Maybe John Hunter, we'll start with you. What stands out to us from that second meeting of that legislative study?
Well, it doesn't appear that we're any closer yet as to being able to craft legislation and so forth. As you know, there are kind of two sides to this, and those who said this could be an agricultural boon for the state or for certain farmers who choose to produce that. And Governor Kristi Noem, being a farmer rancher herself, and supports that, but also recognizes this is a kind of in the family of marijuana and cannabis and so forth, and wants to make sure that doesn't cause problems, which it has caused problems in other parts of South Dakota life. So I think what's coming up, at least according to Governor Noem, is that more questions are popping up every time she gets an answer, then two more questions come up. So I don't think we're any closer to that. The idea generally, Jackie, of these summer studies is to be able to take something that didn't occur last session, maybe in the outside of the glare of the legislative session, study it, put something together, maybe get some other outside opinions put together and prepare for next session. As of the moment, I don't think we're much closer to being able to have any legislation ready.
Right. And John Schaff, how are you following this from a political science perspective, the kind of continuing debate on industrial hemp here versus other areas of the country? How are we kind of stacking up in that conversation?
Well, of course, South Dakota is one of the few states that does not allow industrial hemp, and all of our neighboring states do allow industrial hemp. And I guess what surprised me about this, like John was saying, I think most of us assumed that when the previous bill failed during the last legislative session, that this was mostly because the legislature wasn't really prepared, and more so, I should say, the governor wasn't prepared. I should restate that. It was the governor who was opposed. And that it really was just a matter of getting some education. That's what the summer study was all about. And what we're hearing, for example, is, you know, law enforcement concerned about the ability to tell marijuana from hemp. And will this stress law enforcement resources? And, you know, some weeks ago, our colleague Seth Tupper from the Rapid City Journal, who is, you know, one of our regular junkies, and I think Seth and I talked about it on one of the shows a few weeks ago, he did a long story for the Rapid City Journal. And this does not seem to be a problem in other states, that this ability to differentiate between the two products and the stressing of law enforcement resources doesn't really seem to be anything anyone else is dealing with. So you start to wonder if there isn't something going on, something else going on, that it seems as though South Dakota leaders are way more cautious about this than other states, for good or for ill. We just seem to have way more caution than everybody else does.
And when we're looking at folks who are highly in favor of this industry, I think some people are skeptical, thinking that this is just trying to get a foot in the door to legalizing marijuana, but that's not always necessarily the case. Like, who are, remind our listeners, who are probably most in favor of bringing an industrial hemp element to our state's economy?
Well, this is what I mean. It's somewhat surprising, because what we hear out of our state leadership, on the state and the, you know, our federal leadership over and over, is diversifying our agricultural output. And so when we've talked for, you know, decades about things like ethanol and biofuels and finding new ways to use our agriculture. And here, right in front of us, is this new way that the federal government is allowing states to start growing this product that we haven't been able to in the past. And so you'd think that agriculture would be for this, and that would motivate the state to act. But as you say, Jackie, I think there's some concern that this is a stalking horse for something else. But while other people think that you can clearly differentiate between the industrial side of hemp and that marijuana is sufficiently distinct as a product, that we're playing kind of apples and oranges with the, mm-hmm. with these two things, or marijuana and hemp, as the case may be, some two agriculture products that aren't really alike.
Mm-hmm. In a similar vein, and of course I'm gonna blank on which one it actually was, marijuana or hemp, but a sizable stock of it traveling through South Dakota gets stopped on the way, and we're calling it a hemp bust. What do we know about this story? Either one of the Johns, you can tell me more about this one.
Well, I mean, I think there's, and John, I think, articulated well the difference in these products, but there's also some kind of gray area in between, so, or some products that act like both. And so then they're saying, well, then, if, you know, if it looks like one and it talks like one, is it one? Mm-hmm. And then so it gets down to really having to do kind of samples, laboratory testing, to see maybe how much THC is in there, or where this is on the spectrum of things. And so certainly that would be a challenge for law enforcement. If they stop someone, they have something that looks like marijuana, and then they have to send it to a lab in North Dakota or Pierre or Sioux Falls or someplace in order to see if it's over some limit of, you know, parts per million or whatever. It would be very challenging. I think that's what some legislative leaders said, you know, why are we going kind of partway down this thing? It's going to muddy the waters a bit. So I think I think it would be a challenge. And industrial hemp is not the only non-marijuana product in that family, right? There's a number of others, and I think people are concerned that we'll have a whole bunch of them and not being able to tell the difference.
A federal judge in Montana will hear arguments on September 12th on the merits of a lawsuit brought by tribes against President Trump. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe and the Fort Belknap Indian community hold that the president unconstitutionally violated treaties when he issued a permit for the Keystone XL pipeline earlier this year. TC Energy, formerly TransCanada, filed a motion against federal judge Brian Morris to dismiss the case. SDPB's Victoria Wicks has the report.
TC Energy says in its most recent brief that the 2019 presidential permit does not make way for the entire Keystone XL project. It just authorizes the 1.2 miles of pipeline that will cross the U.S.-Canada border into Phillips County, Montana. TC Energy says tribes have no treaty interests lying within that short corridor. An attorney with the Native American Rights Fund says that stance is disingenuous.
TransCanada or TC Energy is not going to build this entire pipeline and then just stop 1.2 miles from the border and say, well, we didn't get this permit.
NARF attorney Wes Furlong represents Rosebud Sioux Tribe and the Fort Belknap Indian community.
The whole point of this pipeline is to bring oil from Canada to the Gulf Coast, and if they can't cross the border, then the entire purpose of the pipeline is frustrated.
TC Energy wants to start construction while the lawsuit plays out. Furlong says one reason the tribes oppose that proposition is to prevent the tangled legalities that existed with the Dakota Access Pipeline. In North Dakota, DAPL was under construction while opponents had active lawsuits to stop it, and it was all but completed while waiting for its final federal permit to cross under the Missouri River.
That was very important for the tribes to get out ahead and bring this challenge and bring this fight before construction happens, so that sort of situation doesn't happen again.
This lawsuit deals with the second Keystone XL permit issued by the Trump administration. The State Department granted permission for a border crossing in 2017. When federal judge Brian Morris put an injunction on that permit, President Trump issued another one earlier this year. Furlong says Judge Morris found, while issuing the injunction, that the border crossing is just one piece of the entire project. TC Energy did not respond to a request for comment. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
Your data, it's being collected, sold, stolen. But what can we do? Rob Hanemichael is an instructor of information systems at Dakota State University. Earlier this week, I had a conversation with Rob about how we can best protect our data. What can we do?
I think, we see all these data breaches taking place and everybody wonders, how do I protect myself? Unfortunately, our data is out there, whether we've given it or it's been collected somehow. So I think one of the big things that I kind of stress with people is taking your own responsibility in kind of observing your own data. So whether it's putting alerts on your credit card, so if they're used in a weird way that you get a text message, or regularly checking your credit cards or your credit score to see if there's any weird stuff going on there, is one way that you can find out before a data breach actually, gets to the public or to the media.
That advice is important because it seems like there's no way you're ever alerted of these sorts of things. These breaches happen. For example, when we talked over the phone prior to this interview, you had mentioned a website, haveibeenpwned.com, and pwned is spelled P-W-N-E-D, and I found out my old email had been breached 3 times, and I was entirely unaware. So can you talk a little more on that personal responsibility thing?
Yeah, I think that site's, a great way to see if you've ever been compromised or, what type of information. But, if you do go out there, sometimes you'll find a site that was compromised 4 or 5 years ago, and you were never notified, or maybe they took 4 years to notify you. Right now, we don't have any real, federal laws regarding breach notifications. Last year, when South Dakota and Alabama adopted their laws, now all 50 states do have some sort of notification law in their books. Unfortunately, sometimes it is, if they can deem that you're not harmed, then they don't have to notify you. Most of the time, it takes about they have 60 days in the South Dakota law to notify you if there has been a breach and what information has been taken. But, for a long time there, it was, I have a Dropbox account, and Dropbox is one of them that was breached, and it took about 4 years before they required people to change their password and before you were even notified. So it is one of those things that a site like Have I Been Pwned, it allows you as a consumer to go out there and look at your account and then be like, oh, I'm going to go change my passwords. This doesn't look good and everything.
Right. So what are some of the general measures you take and you suggest others take?
So I think, you know, just kind of keeping track of the stuff that you're going to. Like I said, I check my credit card statements, you know, online on a regular basis. So if anything, you know, comes up that's out of the ordinary, I can catch it right away. You know, all your credit card companies through their online allow you to check your credit report daily if you want, doing some of those notifications. But then I think also just, you know, being aware that your data is out there and using sites like Have I Been Pwned or just kind of watching the news too, right? Like I think there's a lot of really good stuff that comes out in data breaches. Sometimes it's based off of an external factor that hacked into it and was able to find it. But then also we see a lot of where people inside of organizations accidentally send out the wrong information and they don't know if that's really a data breach or, you know, how do they contact the people. So I think it is just one of those things where, you know, use the sites that you use on a regular basis, double check like your own financials and any of the weird information that might be out there.
And when one of these breaches happens, and we just say the word data, what exactly does that mean? What is it that's being taken? I mean, my understanding is there's stuff to do with phone numbers, and that can be tied to robocalls, and then there's this exploitation of people. Can you talk on that?
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about your data being breached, you know, it could be anything from any type of personal identifiable information that can link it to us. So sometimes, you know, if they just get like one little chunk, like our first name, that's not a big deal. But if they start tying our first name and our last name and some other identification, you know, now they have enough pieces to be able to do something with that. Yeah, I mean, we see where our phone numbers, it's always interesting when your own phone number calls you, you know, and you're kind of like, how'd they get this and how are they spoofing it? But, you know, there's so much information out there that they're just grabbing and being able to use and then the scams come into it, right? So then we start looking at phishing and spear phishing emails that they know a lot of information about you. And so then we start to think that they're realistic and we bite on them and then we give them more information.
My grandmother, she had a call saying that her grandson, this was her grandson, and he was in trouble and needed help and all of these other things. And it talked about paying in iTunes cards. Can you... Can you touch on that?
Yeah, I think we all have to be realistic that no one will ever ask us to pay through a gift card. You know, if you ever get that question or that's how somebody wants you to pay, don't do it. I think we have to also go back to thinking the way we used to think, right? Like if I get an email from, you know, if my mom gets an email from me saying that, hey, I'm in jail and you need to send this money, I hope the first thing she does is she calls my wife and says, is he really in jail, you know, and like kind of double check on that stuff.
Let's talk about how a bank will contact you.
So one thing I always kind of tell people is if you ever do get contacted by your bank, whether it's through a text message, an email, or a phone call, call your local branch, right? Like if I get a phone call from my bank and they're saying, hey, we need all this information, I'm 5 blocks away from my local branch, right? So it's a lot easier for me to go in there and walk in and say, hey, I got this information, and they'll be like, hey, that's not coming from us. But also, like, I think sometimes when we get those emails or those text messages and there's that link that says, you know, click on this to go change your account information, what I always tell people is don't ever click on the link. Don't reply to that in email. Always contact the location that you want. So either use the phone number of the branch, go to the branch, go directly to their secure website or the app that you have on your phone. And then from there, most of the time when you get there, you know, if there's something wrong, there's going to be a message there for you. And so that's the best way to kind of look at it.
Two Rapid City businesswomen were selected for this year's Native American 40 Under 40 Award. The title comes from the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development. SDPB's China Lockett spoke with LaFon Janis and Kimberly Tilson Braveheart about their award-winning business ventures.
Kim, can you tell us about your businesses?
Sure. We have several businesses. One of our companies is called Painted Sky Management. We are a small business development firm specializing in value-based development in Indian country, as well as serving for professional development in leadership and customer service, as well as management and management analysis. And we've also just recently launched a new company called Etiquette Catering, both owned by myself and my husband. We are 100% native-owned, native-operated. We do farm-to-table, 100% organic. All of our meats are local. Our food is delicious. It's beautiful. It's the best you'll get.
Fantastic. And LaFawn, how about you?
So I have currently Bluebird Consulting, but prior to that, I, you know, would go on with companies in various forms of contracts to help them do business development, leadership management, customer service training. So very similar, and trying to, you know, help also Indian country and corporations and nonprofits here in the Black Hills area. So it's been pretty exciting. I've had some really amazing opportunities come my way, working with youth, working with adults, working on violence prevention, education, bringing in just more opportunities for people to learn and come together.
Right on. And both of you guys are the founders. You guys are business founders and businesswomen working locally in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Yes.
So you just won this national award for Native Women in Business. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. It's not just Native women, it's Native people. Yep, and it's a national award, and what's really nice about it is it really highlights different leaders in all sectors of business, health sector, you know, hospitality business, also government leadership. And really what it does is, like, I was nominated by a client of mine that have been a client for 9 years, and they just have seen my career development and my skills as a leader. And so that's why I was selected. I'm not sure who nominated LaFawn.
So I was nominated by a very longtime friend, actually from high school, and she's watched me also grow throughout the years of, you know, the adversity, the overcoming, coming into leadership, and was just really excited. And it was really nice to have the people, you know, write reference letters and be honored to write reference letters for me. So I thought that was really cool, because it's always really humbling to me and really heartfelt whenever you know that people believe in you.
And so this is a pretty heavy competition. Like, there's got to be a lot of business owners who you were competing against all over the United States. How does it feel to be recognized as an individual in such a small, not very populated state?
I personally don't know that it's competition-based award. I believe that, you know, there's probably some pretty fabulous people nominated. So whether they received it or not, that I think that's really neat to be amongst that group of past and present and also nominees, because I think it's really important in today's modern day that Native Americans come forward and be proud of their work and have the community come forward and be proud of them as well.
I think it's really important. It is considered a pretty prestigious award, especially in Indian country, but outside as well. And it's an honor to be among past recipients. My brother is one, and there are many people that I work with that are. But the other thing I think that's really important to recognize is that visibility of making sure that people are showcasing and seeing that Native people are doing all kinds of really amazing things and are successful and positive and, you know, we are modern-day people just like everyone else that are caring and upholding our cultural values and our culture and our language. And I think that's really important, just to show that we still exist and this is what we're doing.
So I still ride a horse and put up teepees.
Me too.
But but I do drive a car and live in a house. Yeah.
From other articles that I've read about Native people in business, national polls and such, it shows that Native people are often overlooked in the workplace. Is this something you guys can touch on or share your experience with as business owners?
Sure. I mean, I have been in Rapid City now for quite a while, and I've been on different boards with the city and all different things. And one situation, I actually had a woman pat me on the head and tell me how eloquent I was. And I was really actually embarrassed and shocked by that interaction. But I realized, because of that interaction, very much as LaFon said, is that it's important for us to be seen, to be heard, to represent and bring other people along so that they have space as well to say their voice. But I also want to say this too, is that I've now been in business for quite a while here in Rapid City, and I really believe that the small business community here is welcoming, supportive, and we're really trying to lift each other up regardless of race or other differences, is that I feel really lucky to be a part of this business, small business community here.
How important is it to connect with other people that are doing what you're doing in the area, especially other female business leaders and Native female business leaders?
I think it's absolutely 100% phenomenal and needed. Across the country and Indian country and any community, we need to support each other 100%. That connotation that we cannot work together, or
competition's healthy.
You know, and not only that, but I think that you learn from every single person there is out there, and especially in the same fields, just different things you can take away. And I think that's just super important for our communities to have, to collaborate together. Because I do this, one of my projects, you know, I'm reaching out and I'm like, who do you have? Who do you know? And I've been pretty blessed to have such great people that, you know, everybody's willing to help and communicate and collaborate together. And that competition piece hasn't been there thus far in a lot of the education and business that I do.
The thing about business, too, is that there is so much business to be had by so many different kinds of people. And there's so many customers who are looking for very particular perspectives and education and knowledge. And so I really think that it's widespread, that there is enough business to go around. So not to say competition. I just believe that competition is healthy. You know, I don't mean like tearing each other down or anything. I think that it's nice to see what other people are doing, so you can be like, I need to add more value to my business so that I grow and I get better and I offer more opportunities for my clients, is what I'm saying about competition. I feel really fortunate to be surrounded by a community of a lot of really strong Native women who are in business, who are really making things happen for themselves, their people, their families, and their communities. It's an awesome time to be in business.
Fantastic. And you guys both did choose kind of to base your jobs on something that you're passionate about in different fields that would kind of target different people. LaFon, I read a bit about your work with domestic violence. Can you touch a little bit on that?
You know, violence in my life began at a very early age. I would say even from birth, I was a foster child and very young parents who left me in foster child, which is okay, because who knows where I would have ended up if they didn't. And then I went to a home, you know, that was full of emotional abuse and almost to the point of neglect, you know. So I think that's where it began. And then over the years, I, you know, came into a relationship that was pretty harsh emotionally. And even though the child had emotional abuse, this was a different type of abuse. And so I had to really, you know, pull deep to be healthy and get out of that and learn about what manipulation looks like, about what control looks like. And so when I watch these families go through it and I see all of our youth getting into unhealthy relationships at young ages, I mean, it's astounding and it's heartbreaking. And so that's where the passion comes in of we need our future and we need our youth to be healthy. And how do they learn if they don't have examples and, you know, people to help them understand what healthy looks like? So that's where that began for me.
Can you touch a little bit on a mentorship, as long as we're on the topic? Where does it come from for you guys? Where did you find it and where do you provide it for other people?
So I actually did a TED Talk on this, and mentor, I try to stay away from the word because I feel like it feels like work to some people. And so, and you know, Lakota values, we were always taught to, you know, watch how you walk because look who's watching you. And it was the younger ones. And so I feel like it's ingrained in me. But also because of the systems and the oppression and ending up in the foster care system that I did, you know, I would not be here if I had did not have the leaders and mentors and elders in my life that I did. 100% would not be here. And so that's where it comes from. And I guess I just try to lead with that. And, you know, there's times I'm angry. There's times that I'm upset. There's times that I want to not, you know, you have those natural human reactions. And then I stop and take a breath and realize, like, okay, people, these young people are watching, and I just have to lead with grace.
How about you, Kim?
I come from, you know, a legacy of entrepreneurship. I'm a sixth generation entrepreneur. My dad was a single father raising me and my two brothers by himself. Native Jewish kids, we're Sioux-ish. And I think that his perspective and value and support has really helped me in my business. He really makes sure that I am on top of evaluating my business plan and my marketing plan. So his support has been amazing, as well as my brother, Nick Tilson, too. Just really making sure that I understand where I'm coming from, but also, like, one of my friends and his partner, Dana, Sean Sherman and Dana Thompson, have been really helpful in me just making sure that I'm learning more about the food systems and indigenous foods and food sovereignty. And I really feel super blessed that I have an amazing support system of both chefs, non-chefs, and business people that are really rooting for me and having my support. And I also have a dear friend, her name is Sarah Kavanaugh, who literally will just send me a card saying, I know that life can be really challenging. You are running lots of businesses and you have children, but I'm just proud of you. And I literally get them when I need them the most. And that may seem like something very small, but to get something handwritten, it really helps you in those isolating moments.
I love that. Sioux-ish. That is so cute.
It's true.
This has been a fantastic conversation. Is there anything that you guys want to leave us with here?
I think that every week and every day is absolutely different. Some days you get more punches. Other days you get an amazing amount of support. And I just think that that's important to know, that you just have to keep moving.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org. You can follow us on Twitter at @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. Lori Walsh will be back next week, and you won't have to hear this voice ever again. Hopefully. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.